All right, it gives me great pleasure to introduce the man, the legend, Mike.
Yes. Thank you.
I thought you were going to say the man, the myth, the joke, but hey, everybody. My name is Mike. I'm a recovering perfectionist, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. Howdy. I use those two words because they're important to me, recovering and recovered. Because when it comes to alcoholism, I have recovered. Alcohol is not a daily problem that dominates my life. It's not a daily solution that dominates my life. I have other issues that I'm still working on because I'm not perfect by any stretch. And God willing, I'll continue down this path and have the ability and the desire to continue to work on myself and work, to make the world a better place, make the people around me, enjoy me being around, which was not necessarily the case before I came in here. What are we going to talk about tonight? Oh, my favorite subject, me. All right. And alcoholism. So, let's see. I'll try to keep this. I promise we had a little timing issue previously. I promise I won't go past a minute past 9:15, okay? So, all right, so let's see. I'm 47. I never thought I'd live this long. I never thought I'd live to 30, to be honest with you. Man, when I was a kid, even in high school, I was... Oh, my ride's here. when I was a kid, I never thought I would live to see 30. I thought 30-year-old people were so old. Oh, my gosh, ancient. They had nothing in common with me. Nobody understood, you know? But here I am. I don't even know how I made it this far. This is the oldest I've ever been, and I got to tell you, it's difficult. Just get to practice at it. So, let's see. I was born in Pasadena, California, at home, where my family came from. They didn't believe in hospitals and all that stuff, even though, like, my mom's mom was a nurse. Oh, you don't go to a hospital to have a baby? Come on, you have that at home where you're supposed to. I was almost a water birth, almost born in the toilet. I don't know where I'm going with that. Born and raised in Pasadena, California, and very religious family, very devout. We went to church every week. We're very involved in the church that my parents went to. And they sent me to Christian schools. I went to a Christian grade school. I went to a Catholic high school. I went to a evangelical college. And through all of this time, I never found God. I never had a relationship with God. I tried that thing. And I know if those of you that are new and you hear the G word, it's okay. I didn't believe in God either when I got here. And it's okay. You don't have to. As long as I believe it, that's all that really matters for my recovery. And early on, all that really matters was that I believed that some of you believed. You know, because I didn't when I got here. I didn't know what that was. I had no understanding. When I was... 12, 13, I think I was 13. I remember after going through all this school and church stuff and all of these stories that people would talk about, about these burning bush moments and God was filling their lives with this and that. And I never felt any of that. I remember doing that whole trying to ask God into my heart and my life, and I didn't feel anything. And that, I think, is when I finally realized at the age of 13 that I was alone. There is nothing. There's nothing that's going to get me through this life except me. It's up to me. So I better figure something out so that I can get through life. And that's where I started down the path of self-reliance, which took me far in life. It took me far in life. But it didn't get me to where I am today. So, let's see. I had different sets of friends. The neighborhood we lived in, those kids went to one school, but I went to a different school. The school I went to, all those kids went to a different church. And the church I went to, all those kids went to the church school. And so I had all of these different sets of friends, but I wasn't necessarily like a deep part of those groups because I was always somewhere else at other times. So I never felt like I felt fully was a part of those people. And like we hear, I've heard many times how we don't feel like we fit in, we're not a part of, etc. I definitely felt like that. I grew up in a very poor neighborhood at the time. There actually were housing projects in Pasadena back there in the 70s, and we were the only white family in the building. It was mostly black at that point. And then right around the early to mid-70s, the Mexican population started moving in. There was a lot of racial tension. There was a lot of fighting, a lot of, I don't know if there was shooting or not. There probably was. I don't remember it. But our family lived in a constant state of fear because my parents were managing this apartment building right across from the housing project. And it was interesting. If it was after six and somebody knocked on the door, my mom would answer the door with a crowbar behind her back. And my brother and I played this game. It's called run into the bedroom and hide in the back of the wardrobe so that nobody could find us. And I remember the funnest day. It was kind of a guilty pleasure. My dad got us down into the car getting ready to go to church one weekend. And we're sitting there all dressed up. We had to dress up back then to go to church. And I remember my dad didn't come. Finally, my mom said, well, yeah, I better go see what's keeping him. And she went back and brought him out all bloody. And we ended up spending the day in the emergency room because he got beat up. He had the gall to ask somebody for their rent. They were late. And I remember thinking, man, I don't have to go to church. That's awesome. I would rather sit in an emergency room than go to church at that point in time. I don't know. Once I got through high school, I went to college out of town. Because my parents were pretty strict in many, many ways. And I was blessed. My parents paid for my education, paid for me to go to school. And so I made sure that I picked a place that was far enough away that they couldn't surprise me on a visit, but it was close enough I could still ask for money and bring my laundry home every once in a while. But, you know, I only went home that first year, and then after that I never lived in my parents' house again after my freshman year of college. I always found some other place to be, you know, living in Santa Barbara. I mean, you know, Santa Maria is not too much different. It's paradise. It's paradise compared to L.A. You know, the traffic, the smog back then, you know. I didn't have to smoke because I could just go outside and play. You couldn't even see the mountains. They were like 5 miles, 7 miles away. Couldn't even see them during the summer. So, I had a lot of fun. I didn't really drink much growing up. Alcohol was a part of our family a little bit. We would drink on special occasions. You know, my dad might have a special beer. We might have a glass of wine with a special occasion. And they would always give us a sip, you know, just a sip. And I didn't really like the taste of it, but I always associated it with something special. And so I had gotten drunk once or twice, three times in high school. It was horrible, but I had a great time doing it. I had a great time. We had so much fun. But I didn't learn to drink until I went away to college. And it was hard work, because so I didn't like the taste, and I hated the hangovers. I'm one of those gifted people that I had horrendous hangovers. Very painful, throwing up, spins, all that stuff. And I'm a lightweight. I don't have to drink very much to get that way. And that's one thing I'm grateful about this program, that it doesn't matter how much you drink, how often you drink. It's why you drink. And it's what happens when you drink. And that's what matters. I remember coming into this room, maybe not the first time because it's pretty foggy, but I remember reading this right here. And I thought, you know, that's, after talking to a couple of people, after being here for a short time, I realized, you know, whenever I enjoyed drinking, I wasn't controlling it. And whenever I was controlling my drinking, I was not enjoying it. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do both at the same time. And that was the start for me to be able to realize that, you know what, maybe there is something to this. So I got through college. I'm a list maker. Love making lists. I love accomplishing stuff. I've always been very driven, and I love checking things off that list. And I had, even though I didn't really know what I wanted to do, what I wanted to be when I grew up, any of that kind of stuff, but, you know, I knew certain things. I knew that I wanted to be successful. I knew that I wanted to have some stuff. I wanted to make some money, and I wanted to be the kind of person that you could count on. I wanted to be the guy that you could look up to, the guy that you wanted to be around. And I think I had a bit of charisma when I was in high school, in college. You know, I played basketball on the short league, and because I wasn't very tall. And we really did not win very much. You know, maybe if the other team had a broken leg or something, but I enjoyed playing it. I ran track. I did all that athletic stuff. Being the 80s at the time, skateboarding was huge because it was a crime. And so, all teenagers liked stuff that's not allowed. So, we skateboarded everywhere. And we had a great time doing that. So I always considered myself very athletic at the time. And then about 3 weeks before I went away to school for college, I cut my foot halfway off with a circular saw. I was building something and didn't know what I was doing, and ended up cutting my leg. And so my first few months in school, everybody thought I was a mama's boy because I wasn't going out and partying with them, because I couldn't. I couldn't walk anywhere. Just go to class and, sit around the campus. And I think that's when things started to... I looked at the few times that I had alcohol and how I felt and the times that I had, and I knew that that's what I needed, because I was always racked with anxiety prior. I was painfully shy growing up, painfully shy. I could not look at somebody in the eye. I could not talk to them. When I was young and my parents would introduce me to somebody, I mean, when I was a little kid, I'd hide behind my mother's skirt. I'd hide behind her because I just didn't want to talk with them. I would shrink back from whatever the situation was that made me uncomfortable. And what I discovered when I started drinking alcohol, especially when I was getting social with people at school, was that I found a new way of doing something, which was I don't have to shrink away from the stuff that makes me uncomfortable. What I can do is I can put on an act. I can be, I guess the best defense is a good offense. Like, if you're coming at me, the best thing for me to do to keep you from coming at me is to actually come at you. Because then you can't come at me if I'm going towards you, right? Pushing you back. And I don't know if that makes sense, but it made sense to me. It made sense to me that I think alcohol was the fuel that I used in order to get through life. I drank it for the results. I didn't drink it because it tasted good. It definitely didn't make me feel good the next day. But that night, that time, especially since I didn't think I was going to live to be very old anyways, hey, let's do it now. Let's get this now. Let's get it quick. And have the good times while we can. Mm-hmm. And that worked. That worked for a while. I was able to get through school, graduated, and then I started knocking down those things that I wanted to accomplish in my life. I started down a career. I got married, made a family, got a house, did all those material things that we think are gonna complete us, Right. If I get married, if I have kids, if I have a good job, if I make good money, if I get the car, if I get the this, that, I'll be happy. And what I found was that every time I would set my sight on something and I would get to that, I never rested and enjoyed what I had. It's like, oh, I did it. No, I was immediately like, well, what's the next thing I'm going to do? Because it didn't fill that hole that I had. It didn't make me feel complete. And I guess I just had no idea what my purpose was. Like, why am I here? What are we doing here? I don't know what I'm supposed to do. When I was born, they didn't give me the manual, the instruction list on what I'm supposed to do with life. And I didn't realize nobody else got one either until I got here. My 20s was a good time. We did a lot of stuff. The problem was with drinking alcohol to the extreme that I don't remember much of it. You know, and even when I wasn't drinking, because I was so busy worrying about what was going to happen in the future or what had happened in the past, I missed what was happening right now. So I was never here for it. And like, if I don't remember it, did it really happen? Maybe it did for everybody else because they remembered it, but not for me. I missed it. I missed it. And then I would constantly go back and try to reclaim that. You know, I remember the first time I got drunk and what a fantastic time it was, how much fun we had. And I think a small part of me always wanted to reclaim that. I wanted to find that perfect high again, you know? And I never could. I had some good times, but it was never that one. It was never that one. Now, over time, you know, I would drink when I could. I would drink more, looking back as time went on. What really happened with me was once I got through my 20s, I had done the stuff that I had set out to do. I had checked everything off that list. And my parents had always taught me that, you know, when you get started on a career, you work as hard as you can possibly work for the first 10 years. You work nights, weekends, holidays, overnights, you do it. Whatever it takes. Whatever it takes. And then after that, you'll start making some money and you'll be able to take your foot off the gas a little bit. The problem with that is that I never learned how to take my foot off the gas. I was constantly pushing for something else. So even when I was home, I wasn't home. Yeah. You know, I was physically there, but I wasn't emotionally there. I wasn't there for my kids. I realized in 2010 that I had missed my daughters growing up. Was I there physically? Yeah. But there were a number of times I was hungover. There was a number of times I was busy thinking about something else, doing something else. And that was a panic. That was a panic for me. I was definitely a panic when they turned, when she turned 10. My oldest turned 10 and my youngest was 6. It was, so I immediately got on the things of starting to do those things. You know, let's take more trips. Let's go camping. Let's, you know, do all these things. And that helped a little bit because it created some memories for the girls. But unfortunately, I wasn't really there. And when I was there physically, what was happening more and more was I was starting to piss people off. You know, I'd wake up the next morning, pounding headache. Nobody's talking to me. Oh, what did I do this time? You know, did I make some people mad? Did I break something? Did I hurt something? Sometimes I hurt myself. Never meant to, of course, but just things get out of hand, you know, and it's weird how that just seems to happen more and more as time goes on. You know, first it was like once a year, and then it was every 6 months, and then it was every few months. It seems like something was going wrong. Something was going wrong. Well, when I turned 30, I had this, I'm going to jump around a bit because I can't help it. I don't have ADD, but I definitely feel like a dog on the freeway sometimes. Squirrel! So, 30, I remember coming home from work, and I had a bit of a routine, because I'm a creature of habit. I love routines. I love parking in the same spot in the Home Depot parking lot so I can find my car when I get back. Otherwise, I can't find my damn car. Where the heck did I put that thing? I love that stuff. I think it's just to keep me sane somewhat, a little bit. And I remember in the shower after work, having my shower beer. You know shower beers? Anybody? Yeah, shower beer, my favorite. I like that. But I remember thinking, man, is this all there is to life? Like, I get up before the sun gets up. I go to work. I work my tail off all day. I get home, have a couple hours before the, you know, kids go to bed and stuff. And then I get up over and do it again. I mean, is that what my life is all about? I just work, pay for stuff, get a few things, and then wait to die? I mean, is that all there is to life? And I had that soul searching for a couple of years. And I never came up with an answer. I never came up with an answer. I realize now it's because I wasn't paying attention. I wasn't listening. You know, I tried a few churches, and we tried to get into that, and it just didn't work for me. God forbid I volunteer or help somebody for, you know, for free. I always felt like I got the short end of that deal. So I didn't like doing that either. But I finally resigned myself to, you know what, this is it. This is all there is. Like, I've done the stuff that I set out to do. I don't really know what I'm supposed to do now. So I guess I just need to get through it. I've almost felt like I was doing a sentence. I haven't been to jail. I haven't been to prison. I don't know what it's like. So I don't want to equate, you know, how I felt with what some of you have experienced with. But I can tell you I felt like I was in my own prison because I was stuck. I didn't know what I could do with myself, you know. And so I just figured, well, I'm just going to get through the rest of this life as best I can and enjoy myself along the way. And a lot of that was blotting out my existence with alcohol. And that's when my drinking progressed. I graduated. I was no longer drinking, you know, frou-frou drinks and beer and all that. I started switching to vodka because, I mean, come on. It's a good deal, you know. Doesn't take much, and it gets me where I need to go, especially being a lightweight. A few drinks, and I'm there. I'm there. And so I started doing that. And over time, that's where my problems started getting worse. You know how I've heard in these rooms a few things, like when you start drinking, it's all fun and no problems. And then after a while, it's some fun and some problems. And afterwards, it's mostly problems and no fun. I was not having fun. I didn't realize I was miserable at the time, but I was miserable. I was miserable. Like, what am I doing? What am I doing? So I did that for a time. I was not easy to live with. I was not easy to be with. I was not easy to work with. Everybody at work had a nickname for me, and they still won't tell me what it is. I'm sure it wasn't good because, I give people a hard time. I had extremely, extremely high standards for myself, and I expected that same thing from all of you. Like, hey, if I can do this, why are you not doing it? You know, whether it's crawling through an attic or, you know, working a few extra hours or whatever it was, because I was a workaholic. I still am to a certain extent. Not as bad as I used to be, but I work a lot. Something I can continue to try to improve on. But I got to tell you, when I turned 40, I think early 30s is when I crossed that invisible line that I've heard about, where I was no longer just drinking to have fun. I was no longer drinking for the companionship. I wasn't doing any of that kind of stuff because I was never a people person to begin with. That was an act. I didn't like people. I didn't like hanging out with people. I did it because I needed to. But not because I enjoyed it, not because I wanted to listen to what you guys had to say. I just wanted you to shut the hell up so that I could talk, because my story is way more interesting and I'm in it. Yeah? Come on. But after crossing that invisible line, it just started going downhill. And, I don't know how much my girls saw. I don't know, because I was drunk. I don't know. I don't think they saw much, but who am I to say? You know, I wasn't there. But definitely, my wife and I were growing apart. We had an arrangement at the very, very beginning that I was going to earn the money and she was going to spend it. Basically, she stays at home. She's raised the kids. She takes care of the house. And I'll go earn the money, whatever it takes. I mean, there were times that I had 3 and 4 jobs in order to pay the bills and do the stuff that we wanted to do. Because I wanted somebody to stay home and raise these girls, you know. And we never evolved those roles. When the girls got older, they got a little more self-sufficient. They got into high school and stuff. You know, she starts rattling around the house like she didn't have much to do. And I'm always gone. And so what happened to us is we just grew apart over time. And neither of us, well, I, speaking for myself, I didn't realize it. I kept wanting things to be the way they always were. And I think that a number of us alcoholics feel that way, that we want everything to be the same way and never change. Because that's what I'm familiar with. And when it changes, it's unfair. It's unfair. Which is funny because, you know, when we sober up, we expect everybody to account for us and allowing for us to change, right? And sometimes they don't. Sometimes they don't forgive us right away, if ever. Maybe they still expect us to do those things that we did before. And I've realized that if I want the grace from other people to allow me to be a different person, a better person, then, you know, I have to give them that same courtesy. You know, I got to allow them to change. I got to allow them to do their thing. And I did not do that. I did not do that. So, you know, we grew apart. We had a couple blowouts, and you know, she knew that we were broken up before I did. I had no idea. I had no idea. What happened? Well, what ended up happening was I had been taking more and more chances. And I've got to tell you, I've heard so many people in these rooms, and myself included now, say, you know, that we were suicidal, you know? And I, originally, when I first came in here, I thought, nah, that's not me. That's not me. But no, that's not true, because the decisions I made, the choices I made, the things I did are the choices of somebody that wanted to die. The positions I'd put myself in. I always consider, oh man, I've dodged a lot of bullets. Whew. Man, how did I get off so easy, like missing all of these things? Well, no. A sane person, a normal person, never would have put themselves in those positions to begin with. You know, they're not going to do this. Or they might do it once. They're not going to do it again. You know? We do it over and over. At least I did. So, you know, at the end of my drinking, I was definitely at my lowest point. And I have a feeling, you know, Jessica and I were talking about this a while back, that we've heard a number of times, and I think we felt these ways, that... you know, when we get close to our birthdays, we start feeling squirrely. Start feeling like stuff's coming up. We're feeling weird, right? And what we came to the conclusion was, well, wait a minute. Yeah, the birthday's huge. That's the day that we got sober, right? But what about those few days or weeks or months before? Those were the times that we were at our darkest. That was the worst time in your life. That was the worst time in my life. It was right before I stopped drinking. And that makes sense now. It makes sense now that, you know, I do believe that we get this muscle memory. We get this thing in our bodies where we, and in our minds where, you know, we physically relive the past, you know, where we start getting those urges or those feelings of just not feeling right. And that's where going through and asking another man to help and following these steps and making some changes in our lives to do things every single day, take some action, that's what's important. I'll touch on that in the 9 o'clock hour. So, just kidding. So I was really good at making myself miserable. I've heard about people talking in terms of, oh, I drank every day, all day. I woke up and drank. I did all that. I'm one of these rule makers. Like, I have all these rules so that I'm not an alcoholic, that I have this illusion of control. There was a time 2 years before I stopped drinking that I did that. I drank every day, pretty much every day. But I wouldn't drink in the morning because I had to go to work. Would not drink in the morning. I would not drink before noon because only alcoholics drink at noon. So I would not drink before noon unless I was camping or fishing, right? Just could not do that. And then it started being like 11 o'clock. Well, I mean, come on, it's, you know, it's 11 o'clock in New Mexico. I'll just start a little early. I'll just pretend I'm there, you know? And then it was like, you know, I would never drink at work. Yeah. I would never drink at work. Unless I wasn't seeing customers. And then, you know, in the afternoon, I could have a couple of drinks. As long as I'm not seeing clients, right? And I ended up getting a fridge in my office and started filling that up. So that way, when I didn't happen to be seeing customers in the afternoon, I could have one or two or three, you know. And I wasn't really seeing that many customers in the afternoon anymore. I don't know how that happened. But I made all these rules, and at the time I didn't realize it, but I look back and I see... You know, I kept breaking all of these rules that I made for myself because I thought that I had control of this. Yeah, I did this one time where I really need to straighten out, need to get a hold of myself. I've been drinking way too much. I got a New Year's resolution. I'm not going to drink for a while. And so I made that resolution. I'm not going to drink for 3 months. And I did that. I did not drink for 3 months. Now, I was not very much fun to be around at that time, but I made it. And when that 90 days was up, I chose to drink. I deserve it. I just did 90 days, man. I got this thing. So I went back to that. And that's when things got progressively worse, because that's where I started drinking every single day, where I started hiding bottles around the house, where I would sneak out to the garage and have a few sips, thinking, nobody's going to know. How are they going to tell? You know? And, drinking beers and then vodkas on the way home. And all that stuff just progressed. It progressed. It progressed. And then finally, after I had another bad experience, I ended up visited my brother down south. He just bought a house. And I was down there for one of my other jobs. And I had drank on the way down. And I guess I had overshot the mark a little bit, because as I'm walking around looking at his house, it's in the hills. And he's got these big boulders sticking out of the ground. Well, it got dark. He was showing me his house, and I ended up walking right through a plate glass window, and I cut my arm all up. We had to go to the ER. My mom had to take us because we had both been drinking, couldn't drive. I mean, it's not that I wouldn't drink and drive, because I love drinking and driving. Love it. But I couldn't. I physically could not see past the hood, so I could not do it. And I only had one arm because I had to keep holding the other one. It was cut up. So at that point is when I decided, okay, I'm really going to get a handle on this thing. And so I decided, okay, for the next year, I'm just going to have one drink a week. Not one night of drinking, one drink. And let me tell you, the definition of misery is when you're an untreated alcoholic and you limit yourself to one drink. That is not enjoying your drinking. That is not. But you know, I controlled it, except when I didn't. I'd go, 3 months, 4 months, 3 months, right in there, and then I'd go on a mission, and I'd just get completely blasted, because I deserved it, man. I've been working hard. I've been going without. Yeah, I deserve this. I earned it. You know, what's one night? What's the big deal? But, things kept happening. And, not as dramatic as a lot of other people, but, what brought me into these rooms, well, the event that started me down the path of coming in these rooms was I wrecked my car. Well, it wasn't my car. It was my boss's car. But and I did that thing that most drunks do when they wreck a car. Well, first of all, you run. That's what I did.
Yeah.
But I call the cops. They go, I think somebody stole my car. I don't know where it is. And they're like, oh, well, we think we found it. Why don't you come down to the station and we'll take a report? And I'm thinking, oh no, they know, and they knew. I got to tell you, it was at that time that I was out of ideas. When I wrecked my car, I thought I still had the illusion of the power, the ability to do whatever I needed to do to make the world the way it needed to be. But I didn't. I couldn't flip that car back on its wheels. I couldn't inflate the tires. I couldn't do any of that. So I ran. And how I did not go to jail, how I did not get arrested, that wasn't me. How I did not die, that was not me. Because when I saw that car a few days later in the wrecking yard, there is no way I should have lived there. No way. That car was destroyed. And I should have been destroyed with it. Probably because I was so drunk, that's the only reason I didn't die. I was all limber. But, but I was hurt. I was hurt. I peed blood for 2 weeks. As a result of that, that's when I finally came to the realization that my marriage was over, that I was at the end of my rope, that I had no ideas. I had no idea what I was going to do. Couldn't even kill myself. And the suggestion was made to try something, anything, get some counseling, go to AA, do this, this, that, or the other. You got to do something. And I was finally at a point where my ego had been knocked down far enough where I was willing to take somebody's suggestion. And I came into this room, to the 1600 Club. Not right away. I mean, holy cow, you people are a rough-looking crowd. I thought I was going to get mugged or something. I drove around the block a few times. Part of it was, it was a new place. It was people I didn't know. They looked scary. I'm driven by fear. I've always been a fearful person. And I had no idea how many of my decisions, most of them in my life, were based on fear. that I was afraid. I was afraid of not getting something, or I was afraid of getting what I didn't want, or losing something. So I came into these rooms. It was pretty foggy. I got to tell you, I don't remember much from the first little while that I was here. But I can tell you what I do remember are the feelings. And when I walked into this room and I sat over here, what I saw was I saw people laughing. I saw people giving each other hugs. I saw camaraderie. I saw people genuinely caring about how each other were doing. You know, when they would ask, hey, how are you doing? They actually listened to what the person had to say. It wasn't like, oh, I'm just, how you doing? Let me tell you what's happened to me. No, it was actually people were paying attention to each other. And there were real connections. I saw real friendships. I saw real love and attraction for people to actually spend some time together, to actually be a part of each other's lives. And most importantly, what I saw was hope. That's what I saw. I saw people had developed some way to get through this life and be okay. They may not be having the best time. Not everything's going their way. They may have some really difficult times in their life. But you know what? They have a way to get through it with dignity and grace. When stuff would happen, they could walk through it with their head held high. And that's what I always wanted. I was also at that point where I could not look myself in the mirror. I did not like what I saw. I was the opposite. I was the opposite of the man that I always wanted to be. I could not be the man that you counted on. I could not be the man you trusted. I could not be the man you looked up to. And even if you did, I didn't feel like I was worthy of it. I didn't deserve it. But what I did was I started listening as the fog started to clear, and I listened to so many of you in these rooms, Billy, Iris on occasion, when we'd be at the same meetings, every so often Dave, Glennie, Robert, Alex, Jim, all of you guys, even you. And I would also listen to the newcomers like I was, and I would hear what they had to say, you know, because I can learn something from every single one of the people that are in this room, no matter how much or how little time you got, doesn't matter, I can learn something. And so I started paying attention. I looked at that, those steps, and I thought, holy cow, I don't want to do that. But what I did was I had gotten some advice from some people. Sarah, who's not here tonight, but she gave me my big book. Holy crap, was I offended. What an insult. I can afford my own freaking book. I understand now why she did it, though. I understand. And I got some suggestions, and one was to get a sober date and try to stick with it. And even if you can't, just keep coming back anyways. Because hopefully you'll get enough times stopping that you can stay stopped. I was very fortunate. The next thing was to ask another man for help, in my case. And I did that. I asked a man I didn't know. I had heard him a number of times in the meetings, and I don't know, I just connected with what he said and how he said it, even though we were from very different walks of life. And I went up and I asked that man to sponsor me. Can you help walk me through the steps? And that was, at that point, the hardest thing I had ever done in my life was ask another man for help. I don't ask for help. Right. I will figure this out on my own. I cannot appear weak. But you know what he said? He said, all right, yeah, I can help you with that. Are you willing to go to any lengths? And I said, oh, God, I got the one gay sponsor in this group. But I was so desperate, I said, I'm willing to go to any lengths. Fortunately, what he asked me to do was he asked me to write down some stuff. And he asked me to do some stuff. And a lot of those things, I had no idea what he was talking about. And he said, you know, the first thing I want you to do is I want you to be of service to every meeting you go to. You know, go ask the secretary what you can do to help. And of course, the secretary at the time when I asked her, she's like, I don't need any help. We're good. I'm like, what? Fine. I'm going to help anyways, whether you like it or not. You know, so he had given me a number of suggestions, and I took one of those. I just started picking up garbage around the 1600 Club and stuff, because that way I didn't have to talk to all you people. I didn't know any of you guys yet. Why it works, I don't know. How it works, I don't know. But I can tell you that it works. And what it did was it made me a part of this group. And for just a short period of time when I was either straightening out chairs or picking up cigarette butts or trash or whatever, you know, it made me not think about me. It made me think about something other than myself. And that was just the very beginning of it. And so he gave me more recommendations, more suggestions to do things. And we got started on those steps. And what I needed was very, very simple at that time. I'm a very complicated person. I can overcomplicate anything. Anything. I needed simple. I needed not just, oh, I need you to write this. I need you to get a piece of paper, get a pen or a pencil, and here's what you're going to write. You're going to write this exactly. And that's what I needed when I first came in here, is I needed that direction. And I realize now that I was blessed with the willingness to do that. And I was desperate. I was desperate because I couldn't go on. I could not go on the way I was. I was out of ideas. I tried everything I could think of, and I could not get through this life. My whole life, I felt like I was on a treadmill, and somebody was just setting it go faster, faster, faster. I could not keep up with life anymore. But I couldn't jump off it either. I didn't have the guts. So as we did these things, every single step at that point in time seemed like the hardest thing I was going to do ever in my life. But the moment I did it, I realized not only was it not that bad, but I feel better. Maybe not instantly, but over time when I would look back, I would feel better. I was like, oh, wow, that wasn't so bad. I got through it. I did it. And I've heard Keith say that, you know, the steps are loving and kind. And they were to me. They were to me. I've heard other people have different opinions. And for me, those were the steps to freedom. Those were the steps to freedom. When I sat down with my sponsor and we did the fifth step, and he, honest to God, did this. I went over to his house and he sets out three chairs. I'm like, who the hell else is going to be here? And he's like, yeah, no, that one's for your higher power. That's for God. I was like, you guys really do that? Oh, crap. But you know what? I felt it. I don't know if I could say like, yeah, I had a burning bush moment. I don't think it was that. It's just, but something felt different. I didn't know what it was, but it worked. It worked. And we got through that, and we got through the remainder of the steps. And each one of those steps, I just felt a little more free. And when I got to the ninth step, I think that's when I started to forgive myself. That was hard. I could live with everybody else not forgiving me, because nobody was harder on me than I was on myself. And I remember asking my sponsor, Joseph, how do you forgive yourself? Like, what do you do? Like, how do you make that work? And he said, well, the first, I don't remember exactly how he said it, but he said something about like, well, the first step to having self-esteem is doing acts that are esteemable. And I think that's where I got the idea, because none of this stuff is my original stuff, just to let you guys know. This isn't me. Like, I've picked and stolen and plagiarized all of your guys' stuff. This is all stuff that I try to remember so that I can pass it on. It's not stuff that I made up. And but he did say that, you know, we don't deserve this life that we're being given. We're being given an opportunity to be worthy of this life that we've been given. I didn't deserve to get into sobriety. I didn't deserve to have a life worth living, the life that I have today. But every day, as long as I keep doing those simple things, not necessarily easy, but those simple things every day, I have an opportunity to be worthy of this life that's been given to me. And I have a good life today. Has everything changed? Not necessarily. I still work too much. I still have the same job. I can't believe he didn't fire me. I would have fired me if he wrecked my car. but no, I have a good life today. We have a lot of adventures. We have a lot of fun. And any situation that comes up, I have the choice. I have the freedom today to enjoy it. And if I can't enjoy it or I don't want to enjoy it, I can learn something from it. You know, I can take this, even if it's something that seemingly is not what I want or not what I think is the best, because I always know best. Not anymore, but I used to. It's going to turn out okay. It's going to turn out okay. And yeah, life's a lot of fun today. I don't dread Mondays anymore. I mean, I'm not nuts about them. I still got to go to work. But, you know, it's, you know, life's good. Life's good. The suggestion that I would have is come to these rooms, if not this specific one, any of them. You know, these rooms, these meetings, they're kind of like restaurants. That's what I heard somebody say. You can go to any restaurant and get full. You can eat and you will be filled. However, sometimes you need McDonald's. Sometimes you need pizza. Sometimes you need AJ Spurs. You'll get filled on all of them. But you've got to find the one that works for you at that time. And so I go to a number of meetings, a variety of them, because I get a little something at each one, and hopefully I have the opportunity to give something back as well. And that's what's worked for me. But meetings, become a part of fellowship. And if you're not a people person like I wasn't, that's okay. You don't have to be. Just keep showing up. People will reach out to you. Do stuff like, you know, help out with the chairs, you know, wipe down the tables, clean the dishes, throw stuff away. Just, you know, leave the place just a little bit better than you found it. That's what worked for me. Is just leave it a little nicer than when I walked in. And that was one part of making me a part of this thing. Get a sponsor. I highly recommend getting a sponsor. That is actively working the program. Very important. And then strap yourself in. Because you know what? This is going to be a wild ride. That first little while, I mean, there's a reason why I hear it's a miracle that people get a year, because it is. That first year is difficult. And it's difficult differently for different people. You know, I had my own situations, as each of you have had yours over your time here. But you know what? It's been worth it. It's been worth it. And I can't wait to see what happens tomorrow. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike, for speaking tonight. Mike will be available after the meeting. Yes. Let's give him another round of applause.